This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, October 4th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. To tip or not to tip? Tipping culture has become a large conversation in Canada over the past few years, as both customers and service workers across the country grapple with the current cost of living crisis. Receiving tips to supplement a small paycheck becomes all the more necessary, but giving generous tips feels all the more difficult. So how would you react to knowing that a portion of the tips you're giving are not even being collected by the people who are serving you, but rather upper management? This is called tip theft, and in one Atlantic province, it's perfectly legal. Nova Scotia is one of the only provinces in Canada without anti-tip theft legislation, and organizers at the Halifax Workers Action Centre are trying to change that. This week on the show, Rabble Labour reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga sits down with community organizer Sid Bloom to talk about their work organizing workers in Nova Scotia and trying to bring the issue of anti-tip theft to the attention of the provincial government. Here are Bloom and Kaluge-Kasuga in conversation. Take a listen.
So thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
And just to get started, can you tell us a bit about yourself and the Halifax Workers Action Centre?
Yeah, so my name's Sid Bloom. I'm a labor and community organizer living out in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I'm the organizer for the Workers Action Center. So we're a center that was founded in 2017. We're currently the only free legal information service in Nova Scotia that specializes in employment law. So I like to say we sort of have two arms of the organization. The first is the legal information, so providing like direct legal support to workers. And then the second would be, educating and organizing workers to fight for changes in the workplace and for progressive legislation.
Awesome. And kind of on that second point, then, we connected because the Halifax Workers Action Centre is actually waging a anti-tip theft campaign at the moment. So can you tell me a bit about how that got started?
Yeah, absolutely. So the tip theft campaign was born out of intakes coming into the Workers Action Center. Sort of contrary to what people might think, it actually wasn't workers and servers who were coming to us. It was restaurant managers and people who were sort of in that position of power who were coming to us with other issues. And then we're also just noting in our interviews, hey, just a heads up, like, this employer is doing all these unethical things to me, but also like they make me take a certain percentage out of the tip pool and like keep that and the staff don't even know. And we found sort of across the board, like that is what's commonly happening is especially in the restaurant industry, servers are not the people who realize that their tips are being stolen or who are reporting this to us. It's managers in the restaurant industry who are sort of whistleblowing, I guess. And so when we got word that this was happening, this was about spring of last year, we had a fantastic law student who's a former worker organizer who came through the center, who did a research project and put out a survey just looking at tip theft in the service industry and getting a sense of how common this was. And out of that, we got a lot of legislative recommendations and were able to put forward some amendments to the Labor Standards Code that were actually thankfully adopted by the NDP. In the fall, obviously, with a PC government, they haven't passed.
Fair enough. That's interesting, though, what you said that where you've heard this from was actually the managers, and you're saying the employer has essentially made them take part of the tips. So how exactly does that happen? How does that work? What is happening that is putting managers in this position to steal tips?
Well, usually it's pressure from bosses or owners, right? Sometimes it's pressure from other management. And frankly, a lot of times it's people who don't even realize that this is unethical. I can't even say it's illegal, right? Because the province doesn't consider tips to be wages. So this is, in fact, legal in Nova Scotia. So really, I mean, it's just a matter of whether or not this is common practice. So the managers who have been reporting this to us are people who feel it that this is unethical because, they don't feel like they should be taking tips if they're not working the floor. But yeah, more often than not, it's just the way these restaurants work, right?
What do owners or employers tell these managers this money is going towards? What is it being used for, if anything?
Generally, it's used to cover things that you otherwise can't deduct from wages. So breakages or people dining and dashing, sometimes even just to cover manager salaries, right? And to contribute to the operating costs of the business. That's actually the one that we probably hear the most frequently is just that, it's expensive to run a restaurant and margins are really thin. And this is just a way that owners see, to collect a little bit of extra money off the backs of their workers.
Wow. That's really shocking to hear for sure. And I'm curious, you mentioned you've been doing this work since the spring, and I know there's been a survey that's come out kind of talking about the stats of this. Can you tell me a bit about what is the scope of this issue? How many people are affected and how?
So we put the survey out and had about 142 respondents. Of that, about 73% of people had some kind of experience with tip theft. So either they had their tips stolen or they know someone who had experienced tip theft in the industry. So the number was much, much higher than we had thought. And then of those respondents, about 41% of people relied on tips to make ends meet. So the vast majority, that's just to cover the essential bills, right? But most of the people who responded are folks who work in the service industry and rely on tips.
And what was kind of, the sentiment and the stories coming out from the workers when they were talking about this tip theft, especially, in the context of our current, cost of living crisis as things stay super expensive for everyone?
Well, certainly when you rely on tips, especially to make ends meet, I mean, that's getting more and more strenuous as the cost of living crisis keeps escalating. We know that service industry workers are some of the lowest paid workers in the country. I think the average server's wage in Canada is like $16 an hour, something less than that, right? And so with that, I mean, all of these, even, if a manager is skimming 2%, 4%, 10% off the top of people's tips, it's really putting the pressure on workers to be able to sort of recoup that, right? I mean, especially when you think about how much money people are paying for its rent in this city. I mean, Halifax is a city with some of the fastest rising rents in the country. So yeah, every little bit counts. And I think that's just why it's sort of all the more shocking that, the government won't step in and do something about this.
And I'm glad you brought up the government, actually, because that brings me to another question I've had. I know you guys have been doing some work, lobbying the government. And if I understand correctly, Nova Scotia is the only province without anti-tip theft legislation. Have you heard anything from the government about why that is? Do they give any excuses at all? Do they explain their position?
We're one of the only provinces in Atlantic Canada that doesn't have laws banning tip theft, and one of the only provinces in Canada, but I believe there are a couple others. Most of the response from the government, quite frankly, is just that like they don't see this as a priority. They're monitoring, what other provinces are doing and whether that legislation is working out. I mean, it's the same sort of line that the government gives when they want to pass the buck on anything, right? We're monitoring the situation. We're looking at what other jurisdictions are doing. If we ever think it's a problem, we'll do something about it. But until then, workers are SOL. So the response has not been very positive, which is shocking, especially considering industry interests are actually in support of this. So the Nova Scotia Restaurant Association is actually in support of bringing in anti-tip theft legislation. They say that not having this legislation sort of encourages bad actors in the industry. And so given that workers support this and so the industry side interests support this, I mean, it's just all the more shocking that, the PC government won't do anything about it.
And that's interesting, even businesses are for the anti-tip legislation. Can you elaborate a bit on why, what their position is and why it's in their interests as well to stand for this kind of legislation?
So there hasn't been too much in the way of a public statement, but the Restaurant Association in an article a couple years about a year ago, stated that they do support anti-tip theft legislation. And I think the reason they gave was because, to encourage this kind of practice encourages really just bad actors in the industry. And that sort of tracks with what we've heard, right? Certainly, like the fact that managers are coming to us and reporting that this is happening, but also reporting a number of other issues in their workplace, it just goes to show there's a pretty high overlap between, restaurants and employers who are, skirting the law, harassing workers, any sort of number of things that get reported to the WAC, and employers who, commonly will take tips from their workers.
So who is benefiting from this lack of anti-tip theft legislation? If we have people who are against it across the board, why does it still not exist, in your opinion?
Frankly, I think it's a lack of political will. I think this government doesn't care about workers and is not interested in passing pro-worker legislation. I think, frankly, to do that would signal to their donors who are anti-worker that, the government does not, in fact, have their interests in mind, even if they're not directly affected by this. So I think that's why there hasn't been any movement. And then in terms of why our employers practice this, I mean, I think it is, I mean, it comes down to anything, right? Why do employers stifle wages? Why do bosses take, more of the pie than they're entitled to? It's greed, right? It's not valuing the work that people do. And I hear fairly often from employers or from people who don't support anti-tip theft legislation, so who are, comfortable with work employers doing this, that it's only fair, right? It's their business. People wouldn't be getting tips if they weren't, providing some kind of a restaurant, right? And it's sort of the same age-old argument around like who really does the work here, right? Is it the boss for so gratefully providing a workplace, or is it the workers who actually perform the labor and do these sort of tasks? And that's really all it comes down to. It's like any other fight for progressive legislation in labor. Do you care about workers or do you not?
That makes sense. So it's really about trying to build that political will in a sense, and fight for these changes to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
On that topic, what's next then for this campaign?
So over the summer, we've really ramped up the campaign efforts, especially leading into an election year. So we've got a committee of worker organizers, so people in the service industry, and other workers in the community who want to fight for this. And we've been having sort of regular organizing meetings, talking about what the next steps of the campaign are. We did a few actions during the summer. We're planning to do a couple more. And really, it's just about demanding a meeting with the Minister of Labor. And obviously, it's a bit of a tough nut to crack, but I think that would be a huge win for workers. And frankly, it just shows that like we can get this on their radar. Because really, when we talk to politicians about this, even certain PC MLAs, you talk about this sort of gap in the legislation, and they're supportive, but it just doesn't seem to get, run up the poll, right? So clearly, it's a problem with the ministers in charge, with our premier, right? It's not individual MLAs who don't support this. So we're going to fight to get a meeting with the Minister of Labor. We're going to keep doing actions with the legislature. And frankly, we want to start going after the employers directly, right? I think generally we believe that the best way to win meaningful, lasting change is to win these sort of legislative victories. But it's also equally as meaningful or impactful sometimes to just throw yourself at bad bosses, right? So especially, tourist season is winding down. It's not quite as hectic, I guess, for workers in the industry right now. So we're definitely turning our sights towards going after the boss.
I'm curious as well in terms of how you're approaching this issue. There's been, writings in the past that talk about the real solution to the issues around tips and tip theft is higher wages, and that like the whole tip culture in the West can be problematic at times. So I'm wondering, well, first of all, what's your response to that?
So I have my personal response, and then I have the WAC response. And I'll start with the WAC
Sounds good.
response.
Okay, sounds good.
I think at the WAC, we tend to say, when we get caught up in the conversation around like whether or not people should tip or like what the solution, what do we do with tipping culture? We're inclined to say, to change like a culture around tipping, well, is a lot of effort. It takes sort of a massive social change. It's a restructuring of the way that we, do the service industry. Banning tip theft is a line on a piece of legislation, right? It's opening up a Word document and just drafting, the legislation. So we tend to say, let's do that, and then we'll focus on tipping. But just from what we're hearing from workers in the industry is that I think people are sort of sick of the unpredictability around tips. And certainly, I mean, like you hear this from service industry workers a lot, right? It creates unpredictability and financial uncertainty. It makes you really vulnerable to customer biases and preferences. I mean, you can, experience so much discrimination working for tips that you can't ever really pursue, right? There's the need to perform emotional labor. I mean, that's exhausting. And generally, tipping creates a sort of inequality across workplaces. So yes, absolutely. I think, people deserve a living wage. People should just be paid fairly for the work that they do, right? And shouldn't be, relying on the whims of customers. And certainly business owners shouldn't be relying on their customers to subsidize wages and to subsidize their business. So I think ultimately the goal is to win living wages, and then keep tips as what they're meant to be, right? A sort of extra for great service, but not putting that expectation that people have to tip every time, and certainly like taking a lot of the stress off of workers who feel that, you have to put on a smile and sort of grin and take it, to make your rent.
From your answer, I get the idea. Like, there's the long-term goal as well as the short-term goal, which is anti-tip theft legislation. So, I'm curious. You're working with organizers, you're working with workers. How does this campaign contribute to the long-term goal?
I think in the long term, it's about just having organized workplaces. And we have a lot of conversations internally about, organizing workers sort of formally and informally. And we're a really, we're a direct partnership with labor unions. We have, we were born out of the Halifax and Dartmouth District Labor Council. So we don't shy away from being very pro-union, but also recognizing that, we're pro-union, but it is hard to unionize service industry workplaces. It's very hard to unionize in the restaurant industry. So at a certain point, you need to look at alternatives, right? And so we talk a lot about like organizing workers to be able to fight for these sort of changes, not necessarily through a union, but through like informal organizations like the Workers' Action Center, or through these sort of worker organizing committees. And I think when we talk about like building towards the long-term vision, it's about getting people involved in the idea of organizing or the process of organizing and sort of, I mean, it's such a cliche, but like getting people to wake up a little bit, like realize like I have rights, I can fight for these sorts of things. And then just building up all of these little victories, right? It's one thing to be able to say we can write this amazing platform and we can, make all these demands for workers, and we can demand a living wage and, all of this kind of all the kinds of things that like organizations like ours generally fight for. And we do want to do that. And that's coming definitely in the next year or so. But there's also a lot of power in like winning these sort of smaller victories, like going after a bad boss, like getting a manager who's harassing employees, like transferred, to some office where they're not going to bother anybody anymore. Like winning legislation, like the tip theft laws. All of these sorts of things contribute to that, capacity building and the confidence that workers can have to sort of go after these problems and tackle them head on. And so, like, I see that personally as an organizer, as like playing into the long-term vision.
Can you tell me a bit more about the struggles with organizing in restaurants or the service industry, like for the unions, and how does the Halifax Workers Action Center provide an alternative that is still organized?
So I can talk. I've done union organizing work, but I'm not going to talk in specifics around campaigns, just to, so I don't give anything away. Certainly, and I've worked in the restaurant industry. I worked back of house as a line cook for half a decade or probably longer. So I'm very aware of some of the challenges that exist in the service industry. I would say the number one thing is that it's a very high turnover industry. It's not a place where people necessarily see themselves as long term, and that varies, right? It depends on whether or not you're working front of house, back of house. But certainly, servers front of house see this sort of as a temporary thing. Obviously, there's not a lot of lifetime servers around anymore. The next would be just the precarity of the work, right? There's so many restaurants. It's the kind of job that, if you could do it in one place, you could do it at the restaurant across the street. So when people don't like the conditions, they just go somewhere else. And that's becoming, I think, less and less frequent given that, it's so hard to find a job these days. But it's sort of that mentality, right? And then the next would be just the structure. Restaurants operate with a lot of part-time employees. So there is just sort of a lot of instability within the staff. And they create this culture. I mean, this is another thing against tipping culture, right? It creates a culture within the service industry where certain workers are fighting for tips and making oftentimes a lot more money than some of the other people who are working in the restaurant. And I mean, if we're getting into just divides in the restaurant industry, I mean, if you talk about, look at the front of house, back of house divide, there's a divide in the wages, there's a divide in usually around racial boundaries, around gender lines. So it's, sort of an inherently difficult workplace to kind of mend those divides and get people thinking collectively, and then even organizing. So all of these sort of factors, I think, contribute to why it's really difficult to organize unions. So that being said, the Workers' Action Center, I think where we benefit, is sort of almost as like an overarching union. Obviously people don't necessarily chip and dues. They can if they want. Maybe that's a little plug if you want to chip and dues to the WAC. But generally, we're somewhere where you can go where if you want to organize, you can do it with people across industries or across restaurants and workplaces. You're not necessarily bound to the people that you're working with. So with that, there's a lot more freedom and flexibility to pursue different campaigns. And then it's not necessarily like you're putting yourself in the same risk that you would be if, you were going after like one bad boss or one employer where you sort of risk getting fired. It's where you can, go after the government. You can go after someone else's bad boss and support them, and really sort of just build that collective and like community responsibility. But of course, like I'm not trying to say that there's pros to one and not the other. I think ultimately people should have a union at home, at work, and in their communities. But, long-term goals.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But it sounds like this provides kind of a more sectoral, kind of broad organizing solution that allows for people to get involved with organizing and really fight for their rights in the workplace despite, the unique conditions that come with the service industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you again so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. This is so great to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and have a wonderful rest of your day and good luck with getting that meeting with the minister.
Thank you. Fingers crossed.
That was Sid Bloom from the Halifax Workers' Action Center alongside Rabble.ca labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga. Thanks so much for that, Sid and Gabby. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In national news, this week was the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, a day where Canadians acknowledge the country's legacy of violence and discrimination against Indigenous peoples. Ahead of the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, NDP MP for Winnipeg Centre Leah Gazan introduced a bill into the House of Commons that would make it a criminal code offence to deny, justify, or condone the violence and abuse Indigenous people were subject to at Indian residential schools. In an interview with Rabble.ca, Gazan said, quote, "There's never going to be reconciliation in this country in the absence of justice," end quote. In labor news, the Public Service Alliance of Canada is slamming the Treasury Board over their back-to-work policy. The Treasury Board, which oversees much of the federal public service, is requiring workers to work in the office 3 days a week. During the pandemic, most federal employees were moved from the office to work from home. Many workers were hired as remote workers, and some workers chose to move away from big cities thanks to the freedom that working remotely offered them. The Public Service Alliance of Canada is saying that the Treasury Board's new in-office policy is not supported by evidence. A report obtained by the Public Service Alliance of Canada said that 89% of surveyed workers found that remote working allowed for a better work-life balance. In Alberta politics, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith is moving ahead with discriminatory policies targeting trans youth in that province. Under Smith's rules, trans youth will be required to receive parental permission before their correct pronouns are used in schools, and will be barred from receiving gender-affirming care. Studies have shown that using their correct pronouns and names and receiving gender-affirming care reduces the rates of suicide in trans youth. Rabble columnist Charlotte Dalwood explains that these policies are aimed at erasing trans individuals from public life, writing, quote, "If trans youth don't have access to puberty blockers, it will be that much more difficult for them to grow into trans adults. That's why, too, this government wants to require schools to obtain parental consent before teachers affirm a student's chosen name and pronouns. Because then, trans children who might not be able to come out safely at home might not come out at all." End quote. Staying in Alberta politics, Premier Smith was at the center of another controversy this week, as she was, once again, found to be promoting conspiracy theories. This time, she was promoting the old theory that the government is spraying chemicals in the atmosphere, so-called chemtrails, for some unknown and presumably sinister purpose. At a meeting of fellow party members, Smith was asked by a member of the audience as to what she was doing about chemtrails. Instead of dismissing this conspiracy theory, Smith admitted that she'd been looking into it. Smith went as far to say that she had been in touch with a woman who, quote, "is responsible for controlling the airspace," end quote, who told her no one was allowed to disperse chemicals in the air. This is just the latest example of conservative parties, both at the provincial and federal level, embracing unfounded conspiracy theories. And finally, in arts and entertainment news, freelance writer Doreen Nicol recently profiled a trailblazer in Canada's theatre scene, Radha S. Menon. An actor, playwright, and founder of Hamilton's Red Betty Theatre, Menon is dedicated to sharing stories of feminist, Indigenous, Black, and other diverse artists. Menon established the theatre in 2011, and since then has garnered praise and accolades, including the City of Hamilton's 2020 Arts Innovation Award and the 2016 Theatre Award. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.